Well, as we bring Numbers to a conclusion, I hope that you've been surprised by the amount of history, legal precedent, and establishment of God's principles that we have found here. And that this is anything, the book of Numbers, but a bland accounting record, as the name kind of implies. Last week, we began Numbers 35, and that chapter discusses the establishment of what amounts to the tribe of Levi's inheritance in the Promised Land. And this was to be the assignment of these 48 cities to the Levites. Now, these cities were to be scattered throughout the landholdings of the 12 tribes. Their location would be selected by the 12 tribal leaders. Six of those cities would have a special designation as sanctuary cities, cities of refuge, with three of them located outside of the land of promise, therefore on the east side of the Jordan River, within the territories of Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. So let's reread a portion of Numbers. We're going to start at chapter 35 at verse 13 and go to the end. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 193. Numbers chapter 35, we're going to start reading at verse 13. In regard to the cities you are to give, there are to be six cities of refuge for you. You are to give three cities east of the Jordan, the Jordan, three cities in the land of Canaan, and these will be cities of refuge. These six cities will serve as a refuge for the people of Israel, as well as for the foreigner and the resident alien with them, so that anyone who kills someone by mistake may flee there. However, if he hits him with an iron implement and thus causes his death, he is a murderer, and the murderer must be put to death. Or if he hits him with a stone in his hand big enough to kill someone and he dies, he's a murderer, and the murderer must be put to death. Or if he hits him with a wood utensil in his hand capable of killing someone and he dies, he's a murderer. The murderer must be put to death. The next of kin avenger is to put the murderer to death himself. Upon meeting him, he's to put him to death. Likewise, if he shoves him out of hatred, or intentionally throws something at him, causing his death, or out of hostility strikes him with his hand so that he dies, then the one who struck him must be put to death. He's a murderer. And the next of kin avenger is to put the murderer to death upon meeting him. But suppose he shoves him suddenly, but without hostility, or he throws something at him unintentionally, or without seeing him, being his enemy, or seeking to harm him, he throws a stone big enough to cause death and the person dies. Then the community is to judge between the one who struck him and the next of kin avenger in accordance with these rules. And the community is to save the killer from the next of kin avenger. The community is to return him to the city of refuge from which he fled. And he is to live there until the Kohen HaGadol, the high priest, who was anointed with the holy oil, dies. But if the killer ever goes beyond the limits of the city of refuge he fled to, and the next of kin avenger finds him outside the limits of his city of refuge, and the avenger kills the killer, he'll not be guilty of the man's blood, because he must stay in his city of refuge until the death of the Kohen HaGadol, high priest. But after the death of the Kohen HaGadol, the killer may return to the land he owns. These things shall constitute your standard for judgment throughout all your generations, wherever you live. Now, if anyone kills someone, the murderer is to be put to death upon the testimony of witnesses, but the testimony of only one witness will not suffice to cause a person to be put to death. Also, you are not to accept a ransom in lieu of the life of a murderer condemned to death. Rather, he must be put to death. Likewise, you are not to accept for someone who has fled his city to a city of refuge a ransom that would allow him to return to his land before the death of the priest. In this way, you will not defile the land in which you are living. For blood defiles the land. And in this land, no atonement can be made for the blood shed in it except the blood of him who shed it. No, you're not to defile the land in which you live and in which I live. For I, Adonai, live among the people of Israel. There is a concept here that needs some discussing, and that concept is sanctuary. Another word that could be substituted for sanctuary is asylum. Now, where did this notion of asylum come from? This idea that there is a place or a person who's afraid of the government, whatever that government is, in the form of a tribal leader or a judge or a king or whomever, where he can go and be protected from arrest and punishment. And the punishment that the asylum seeker is inevitably running away from is the death penalty. Now, first, as you've probably guessed by now, the concept of asylum or sanctuary was not invented by the Hebrews. It was a long-established part of many Middle Eastern cultures' justice systems. Yet the basic premise, in its purest sense, is a godly one. Now, second, as a result of it being the norm for virtually all known Middle Eastern societies of that era, it existed among the Hebrews in one form or another. Various cultures enacted it in differing ways. Usually, it involved fleeing to the priests or standing inside the temple that was dedicated to whatever god was currently important or supreme to that nation. We find the earliest record of what the Hebrews accepted as the place of sanctuary back in the book of Exodus. And where that sanctuary place is located is a little bit of a surprise. Back in Exodus 21, 12 through 14, we learn this. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. However, a man acts presumptuously towards his neighbor, so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar, that he may die. In other words, as was so typical in those ancient cultures, it was the altar of burnt offering for their god that was the original place of sanctuary. So before the Lord gave the full law to Moses, it was the practice for an Israelite man to run to the altar, as we're going to find out in later books of the Bible, to actually grab hold of the horns of the altar as a sign he's seeking sanctuary. And as long as he stayed glued to that altar, he couldn't be touched. So here in Numbers 35, Yahweh orders that he wants the principle of sanctuary to be carried out, which means both that the people, that God accepts this principle, and that in order for it to be valid, his people must follow his procedures of asylum. Now, since there were no sanctuary cities until they had entered the Promised Land, what was used before that time? Well, it's unimaginable that a regular Israelite was allowed to touch the brazen altar inside the tabernacle compound. And certainly he could not have gone inside of the sacred tent. Likely the camp of the Levites itself served that purpose. However, since the Torah doesn't tell us, that's just my speculation. Something during all that wilderness journey served as a place of sanctuary, because it wasn't possible within the cultural norms of that day to not have a place of asylum. But as the centuries go by, we find that the Israelites never fully instituted the system that the Lord gave to them. There were sanctuary cities, but in some eras, they were either not in use or there were other means of sanctuary in addition to the asylum cities. We read in David and Solomon's era that apparently the idea of coming to the altar for sanctuary and then grasping its horns still existed among Israel. In 1 Kings, starting in verse 47, it says this: "And moreover, the king's servants came to bless our Lord King David, saying, May your God make the name of Solomon better than your name, and his throne greater than your throne. And the king bowed himself on the bed. The king has also said thus, Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who has granted one to sit on my throne today, while my own eyes can see it. Then all the guests of Adoniah were terrified, and they arose and each went on his way. And Adoniah was afraid of Solomon, and he arose and he went and he took hold of the horns of the altar. Now it was told Solomon, saying, "Behold, Adoniah is afraid of King Solomon, for behold, he has taken hold of the horns of the altar, saying, 'Let King Solomon swear to me today that he will not put his servant to death with the sword.'" Let me also point out how diminished the priesthood was during David's and Solomon's reigns, and how, even though we ascribe this man David as close to God's heart and Solomon as a very wise man, they were far from perfect. No priest ever should have allowed a regular Israelite, let alone a criminal, to defile the altar by touching it. But apparently, this episode in Kings means that the practice was known and it was accepted by both David and the priesthood, at least for some period of time. The question becomes then, what is it about the altar that caused heathens to use it as a sanctuary? And then at times in Israel's history, the Hebrews even did the same thing. It's because whatever touches a holy object becomes holy itself. This is a guiding biblical principle. We saw it with the fire pans that Korah and those 250 men brought before the Lord. But because these men and their fire pans were unauthorized to come before the Lord, they were destroyed. They were made holy by being so near to God, let alone touching a holy object. This falls within the Levitical law that holiness, as well as impurity, can be transmitted from person to person, object to object, even person to object and object to person. Thus, the fire pans, which had contracted holiness, were beaten into a lid for the altar. The coals and the incense ashes that were in those fire pans were taken outside of the camp and destroyed. God's ordinance does not allow human hands to touch the altar or any sacred implement. The one exception is that priests, for certain well-defined purposes, such as transporting the objects, can at times necessarily touch those objects. But even then, because a human has touched them, a measure of defilement gets passed along to it. And that is one of the primary reasons for Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. On that day, the high priest can sprinkle blood of atonement on the physical things of the tabernacle, or then later the temple, and therefore cleanse them. Otherwise, the building up of defilement from the nearness to humans would eventually make the sanctuary and all of its ritual objects so impure that God couldn't dwell there anymore. So the use of sanctuary cities for the Israelites could only occur once they were inside the Promised Land. But like so many of God's ordinances, they managed to ignore and modify God's laws in regard to asylum. So exactly how asylum was accomplished changed and went to and fro over the centuries. Now, besides the basic importance of our understanding how the principle of sanctuary operated in Israel, I expounded on this matter because it's important to understand that just because we read of certain things happening in the Bible as historical fact, it doesn't make what happened or what was stated by some biblical character as automatically right or righteous before the Lord. I gave you the example of David and Solomon allowing the practice of ordinary Israelites, even criminals, latching on to the horns of the sacred altar, which defiled it. We covered a couple weeks ago the matter of vows and of Jephthah, who made this rash vow to the Lord that wound up in his sacrificing his own daughter. So we have to be very careful when reading the Bible to distinguish between the absolute perfection of the divine laws and ordinances and principles laid out by God versus the imperfect way that often even great men and women of the Bible thought about these laws or carried them out. Now, we tend to get into a mindset that because a special person in the Bible, like an Abraham or a David or a Paul even, did something a certain way, that made it automatically godly. It's our duty, matter of fact, it's our job, as followers of the God of Israel, to study the Torah, to study all the scriptures, to thoroughly understand the Lord's character, his principles, in order that we don't misconstrue what we read in the Bible, whether it's the Old or the New Testament. Beginning in Numbers 35:16, we receive the laws concerning manslaying, killing, and whether the slaying of a human is to be considered murder, manslaughter, or something else entirely. And as we covered back in Leviticus, intent is the key to making this determination, just as intent is the key to determining the seriousness of any and all sins. And in order that it be made clear just what the Lord considers homicide versus accidental killing versus justifiable taking of a human life, we get this series of examples. And the first example revolves around the implement that was used to cause the death. And the principle is that if such an implement was designed for the purpose of inflicting harm, like a spear, a bow and arrow, a mace, then it is a weapon. And if it was used in the killing, then the act generally ought to be seen as murder. It wouldn't if it was in battle, but otherwise it's murder. If an implement that was not designated as a weapon, but if used improperly, it could certainly be a weapon, something, say, with a handle on it, like an axe, then it's still murder. And the Lord unequivocally and without apology says, the person who commits murder is to be executed. Further, this person can't buy his way out of the sentence. He isn't permitted the grace of being housed and protected in the cities of refuge. Now, the reason for this attitude about killing the murderer is one that's come under fire around the world. Everywhere, the cry is that while it is wrong to murder, it's also murder to put the murderer to death. Another refrain is, what good is it to take another human life since it won't bring the dead back? Or that this is not rehabilitation, it's revenge. Well, certainly it will not bring back the life of the one who was slain, nor does it offer rehabilitation to the criminal. But in the Bible, that's not the issue. Sadly, it's a huge portion of the church that has led this charge to rebel against God's instruction on murder. The reality is that God says plainly, a murderer, and it's well defined what that is to immediately forfeit his own life. Why? Because life is invaluable. And the only atonement for the illegal and unjustified taking of life is the execution of the perpetrator. The act of executing a criminal guilty of murder is just. And it's necessary because the blood of the innocent, we're told, over and over defiles the land. And the only way to cleanse the land from this defilement is the atonement provided by the blood of the murderer. This is a Torah principle, plainly stated in our Bible. but it has been lately rendered as an ancient superstition, or it's barbaric, or it's something that Jesus supposedly overturned. However, from the biblical view, the taking of the life of a criminal is, from a higher level, actually the protection and preservation of innocent life. That is, the person who commits homicide is liable to do it again. Why should the next innocent victim pay the price for what this criminal has done? Or as we see it today, why should we warehouse a murderer at a cost to the public of, say, $50,000 a year just so he can exist to attack prison guards and other fellow inmates? Sadly, as Western society increasingly turns its back on what God has ordained as just punishment for violent crime, we see the criminal being turned back into society again, only to quickly find another victim because, unfortunately, violence has become that person's nature. Now, I want you to hear me on this. There is only one way for us to justify not executing a murderer. One way. And that is if we decide we are against the Word of God. And the way we have done this is by saying that that section of the Bible, the Torah, that deals with all these matters so forthrightly, well, it's abolished now. It's dead and gone. So it doesn't even apply. I'm going to say straight away that if we're going to even entertain the notion that the Torah is dead and gone, then so are the Ten Commandments. Because they're simply the first 10 of the 613 laws of Torah. That's all they are. Yet so hypocritically, many of us believers will declare that the Old Testament isn't for us, and yet how many of us would walk through the doors of a church that didn't have a copy of those Ten Commandments displayed in some prominent place in their sanctuary? We've got them right up there on the stone tablets. If a church really believed what they say they believe about the law, how many sermons would have to be discarded because they mention the infallibility of the Ten Commandments, which is just the law in Exodus? See, we believers get so confused on these matters because we have demanded that the Old Testament is to be considered invalid, even though Yeshua himself went out of his way to tell us point blank that we should never think such a thing. And that if we want to know if there will ever be a time when the Torah and the laws and the prophets are abolished, you know when he says that it will be? After heaven and earth passes away. Now, I don't want to detour too long, but by way of example, some time ago I had a pastor tell me that when Jesus spoke those words about the law and the prophets not being abolished, that he was only talking to the Jewish people. So it applied only to the Jewish people. So I trapped him. And I said, okay, do you know exactly what passage those words are spoken in? He said, not off the top of my head. I then asked him what he thought the most important message was that Jesus ever gave to the church. And he said it was probably the Sermon on the Mount, which, by the way, I fully agree with. Well, to his surprise, maybe to yours, those words of Yeshua steadfastly and plainly maintaining the validity of the law and the prophets were in Matthew 5, 17 through 20, smack dab in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount. And a deceived church that prefers our own image of God instead of who he actually is generally to blame. And this is why Seed of Abraham and so many other congregations around the world have been formed in hope of restoring the sanctity and the authority of our entire Bible. to be our guide and written source of God's general will. Now, back to the study here. In verse 19, the Lord says that the person who is to be the executioner for this murderer is the blood avenger. The Hebrew term is Ga'el, or Go'el, or better, Dom Ga'al. Dom means blood, and although the word Ga'al is usually translated as avenger, it more means redeemer. So it is the blood redeemer, more commonly known as the blood avenger, who is assigned to kill this murderer. Now, inherent in the Hebrew term Ga'al is that the person is a relative. He's a member of the victim's immediate family or clan. And it is the Dom Ga'al who's to take action on the offender. Now, let's understand, this is not a tradition. This is God's law. We just read it. Now, I don't want anyone leaving here saying that Tom Bradford says that here in America or even anywhere in the Western world, we should take out personal justice on someone who's done violent crime to one of our family members, or that if we don't do this, we're somehow disobeying God's laws. Rather, the principle behind this law is that true justice is life for life. Specifically, when the life taken was done on purpose, it was done unjustly. Once Israel started being ruled by kings, we're going to find that those kings invariably sought to stop the practice of the Dom Ga'al going after the criminal that had harmed his family member. And this was because in a structured and a settled society with a well-organized human government, it would be chaos if every man determined another man's guilt or innocence for himself and then sought to be the one who carried out the sentence. But also understand this, the principle remains. Just because of man's sinful nature and our imperfect justice system, that doesn't mean that the godly concept of the blood avenger is dead and gone. In fact, it's what one of the primary duties of the kinsman redeemer to be a blood avenger. I hope you heard that. Okay? Just as we believers tend to discard those unwelcome characteristics of God, such as his severity and his wrath, in favor of his mercy and love, we also tend to picture the kinsman redeemer as a wonderful, kindly fellow whose job is as a rich uncle who runs around rescuing poor relatives from the bank who's coming to foreclose on their land. Well, certainly one function of the kinsman redeemer is to assure that land that was originally in his clan never leaves it. Or if a family member were made a slave, he would pay off a personal debt that person could be purchased back out of slavery. But another equally as important role of the kinsman redeemer is to behave as a blood avenger. Is not Jesus Christ, Yeshua HaMashiach, called our kinsman redeemer? Then understand, he wears the mantle of both aspects of that title, not just the one that we prefer. When he came the first time, it was indeed in that aspect of the kinsman redeemer that selflessly buys back a person's life from slavery. And he bought our lives back with the only way God sees as a permanent solution, with his own life and his own blood. When Jesus comes again in the near future, oh, it's still going to be as the kinsman redeemer. But this time, he's going to come in the role of the Dom Ga'al, the blood avenger. He has already purchased the souls of God's people, and he did so some 2,000 years ago. Next, he's going to take out God's wrath on those who persecute his people, those who refuse to submit to his Father. And we see this most starkly as he becomes this fierce warrior leader leading the charge at the Battle of Armageddon. the formerly mild and meek Messiah will be taking lives at the rate of thousands, we're told, every time he swings his sword. Filling, again we're told, the valley of Jezreel, 3 feet deep, with the blood of those against whom he is exacting the Lord's justice. Yet what kind of justice would it be if a victim's life was taken accidentally, even if some low degree of negligence was involved, and the perpetrator then was hunted down and killed for it? Therefore, verse 22 gives us circumstances as examples of accidental killing, such as somebody getting angry and then just shoving somebody without intent to kill them. Or perhaps a person threw something at the victim, but again, not with the intent of severely injuring that person, certainly not meaning to kill them. Then provided a counsel decides that there was no malicious intent to kill, the perpetrator is to then be given safe harbor from this blood avenger. This type of killing is what us moderns might term negligent homicide or manslaughter. Now, if unintended killing is the judgment of the council of elders, then the perpetrator is to be ushered into one of the 6 Levitical cities of sanctuary, where the blood avenger may not go after him. However, this does not relieve the perpetrator of his responsibility for the death of that victim. And even more, it does not relieve the duty of the Dom Gaal to kill that person. It's just that there is a place that is off limits to the blood avenger. So as verse 26 states, if the perpetrator of manslaughter, accidental killing, stays safely inside that sanctuary city, he's protected. But if he ventures outside, wants to go to a movie, he wants to go outside of that asylum city, he becomes fair game. And if the blood avenger spots him and kills him outside the city limits, then it's considered justice. Then there is this interesting remark in verse 28 that adds a really important caveat to this whole procedure. The perpetrator of the manslaughter remains in his blood guilt no matter how accidental it might all have been, and therefore is exiled to the sanctuary city until the high priest dies. When the current high priest dies, whether that comes a day or whether it comes 50 years after the perpetrator is sent into protective asylum, then the blood guilt is removed, he is forgiven, and the Dom Gaal is no longer allowed to take that person's life under any circumstances, and the perpetrator can now return home free of fear of the Dom Gaal, but also he is cleared in God's eyes of his blood guilt. What a strange thing. What's happening here? It's this. The only way a manslayer can have his guilt before the Lord atoned for is for the high priest to pay for it with his life. The death of the high priest, I mean, we're talking about a natural death here, becomes the God-accepted atonement for the perpetrator of manslaughter. But this eventually created a societal problem, because it didn't take long for a manslayer to see the rather large advantage for a high priest to die as soon as possible. Mothers of high priests began bringing food and gifts to the perpetrators in exile so they'd be content enough in their asylum not to become so impatient they might actually start to pray for the high priest to die so that they could return home to their families and resume their lives. We actually have a record of this concern in the Mishnah. Verse 30 says that a person can only be declared a murderer provided there are sufficient witnesses to his act. Hearsay, or even only one witness, is not sufficient, because the matter is just too serious. Now the crux of the matter is stated in verse 33, although I touched on it earlier. There is a spiritual reason for all of this complexity concerning the loss of life. Blood spilled on the land of God pollutes and defiles that land. And of course, the blood that's being spilled is assumed to be blood that has been spilled unjustly. Further, every death pollutes and defiles, and so the impurity of spilled blood and of death piles up and up on the land, thus causing the ritual purity of the land to become greater, impurity rather, to become greater and greater. And the inherent understanding is that the Lord in all of his holiness, he can't dwell on a land that is thoroughly defiled. And the Lord desires with all of his being to dwell with his people. So much so that he gave his only begotten Son, that those who will trust in that reality will dwell with the Lord for all eternity. That is the whole point of his plan for mankind. Let's go on to Numbers chapter 36. We'll read this and just have a few things to say about it, and we'll be done. Page 194, if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Numbers chapter 36. The leaders of the clans of the family of the descendants of Gilad, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of the descendants of Joseph, approached and addressed Moses and the leaders, the heads of the clans of the people of Israel, and they said, Adonai ordered my Lord to give by lot the land to be inherited by the people of Israel, and my Lord was ordered by Adonai to give the inheritance of our kinsmen, Tzelochad, to his daughters. But if they get married to anyone belonging to another of the tribes of the people of Israel, then their inheritance will be taken away from the inheritance of our ancestors, and it'll be added to the inheritance of the tribe they will then belong to. Thus it will be taken away from the sum total of our inheritance. And when the Yovel, the Jubilee, of the people of Israel comes, their inheritance will be added to the land possessed by the tribe they will then belong to and be subtracted from the inheritance belonging to the tribe of our ancestors. Moses gave this order to the people of Israel in keeping with the word of Adonai. The tribe of the descendants of Joseph is right in what it says. Here's what Adonai has ordered concerning the daughters of Zelophehad. Let them be married to whomever they think best, but they must marry only into a family from their father's tribe. In this way, no inheritance of the people of Israel will move from one tribe to another. For each of the people of Israel is to hold on to the land for inheritance belonging to his father's tribe. Every daughter who possesses any inheritance in any tribe of the people of Israel is to become the wife of someone from the family of her father's tribe, so that every one of the people of Israel will stay in possession of his ancestors' inheritance. Thus, no inheritance will move from one tribe to another, for each of the tribes of the people of Israel will hold on to its own inheritance. The daughters of Tzolochad did as Adonai had ordered Moses. Machla, Tirzah, Hogla, Milcah, and Noah all got married to sons of their father's brothers. They were married into the families of the descendants of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, and their inheritance remained in the tribe of their father's family. These are the mitzvot, the commandments, and the rulings by which Adonai gave through Moses to the people of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan, across from Jericho. In an earlier chapter of Numbers, Moses ruled that the daughters of Zelophehad could inherit their father's land portion because He died without having any sons. But this has the potential for catastrophe. What would happen if any of his daughters married someone outside of Israel? Since it is the husband who owns whatever his wife has inherited, the land would be lost to foreigners. That's how bad this could be. But the problem that's addressed in chapter 36 isn't quite that global. The concern that is addressed is less about what happens if a Hebrew daughter who holds land in Canaan marries outside of Israel than what happens if that same girl marries outside of her own Israelite tribe. That is, that a girl from the tribe of, say, Simeon, for instance, marries a man from the tribe of Gad. Then there would be a situation whereby the territorial allotment that God has assigned could be bled off into another Israelite tribe, thus upsetting both the fairness and the balance, as well as God's will, in those territorial assignments that had been made. So here in verse 6 is the judgment of God through Moses on this situation. A female with land rights can marry anyone she chooses, as long as it's within her own clan. Notice that the term used here is clan. Although almost everybody translates it at tribe, it is not tribe. It is clan. They not only had to marry within their own tribe, but within their own extended family. And if they did otherwise, they would be stripped of their land inheritance. And thus, at the end of this chapter, it makes it clear the daughters of Zelophehad married their first cousins, thus obeying God's orders. It is clear that, as one might expect, the unit of family that the people of Israel most cared about wasn't their entire tribe, it was their immediate clan. And in order that one dominant clan within a tribe not carry too much power, which in ancient times was expressed by land and livestock, God orders that daughters who have inheritance rights must marry within their own extended families. This is not the last of the instructions that we're going to get regarding the use and the transfer of land within Canaan. Deuteronomy has several more instructions established by means of precedents on this subject. You know, we are so urbanized today that we tend to forget about the importance of land. But to God, land's important. And the promised land is a major ingredient to his overall plan. And that land that the Bible calls Canaan is specifically set aside for Israel. Always has been, always will be. The Lord will go to great lengths in the Torah to ensure that that land is never to leave the possession of his people. But it happened anyway. The cause was multifold, but primarily it was Israel's apostasy against the Lord. From the moment the land was handed over to Israel, they were going to play fast and loose with God's ordinances regarding the land, and the consequences are still playing out every evening on our TV sets. And it's amazing, I think, that all recent government administrations of America and of Israel are so blind to God's laws concerning the land that their solution to the problem of continued violence against Israel is to continue to give it away to the descendants of people that God ordered it be taken from. As we continue our study of Torah in the book of Deuteronomy next week, the folly of this decision is going to become much more clear. Next week, we'll begin the final book of the Torah, Deuteronomy.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them, merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.